Not used to doing these in the morning.
Too sober?
Yes. Yes. A little bit hungover.
That'll happen.
Oh.
5th of July productivity.
Yeah. Yep. Welcome back to Switchcast. This is part two of our three-part special series on the history of Cannonball Records, all the way from 1903 to present day. And tonight we are talking about the second era, which is the Cannonball and U.S. Express races that happened in the 1970s and 1980s. And who better to join me in recounting these records and the stories that go along with them is none other than Mr. Ed Bolian, the some might say the godfather of modern Cannonball Records. Although Alex Roy might like that title, I think he's the pioneer of modern Cannonball. But anyway, he's done a lot of research on these records. He's been a longtime Cannonball Run fan, and that inspired him to break the record in 2013. So I wanted him to come on both for his historical knowledge of these records and his unique and wonderful perspective on such things. So welcome, Ed. Thank you for joining us.
Great to be here. Thank you for having me. Always fun things to talk about.
Always fun things to talk about. Always very fun things. So we'll get right into it. Well, we're not going to get right into it. I have to do a little plug for the Minerva Cars Are the Stars event coming up September 14th. So if you think that hearing about Cannonball Records is interesting, what better than to see the actual cars in a visual lineup of the fastest times from 1903 to present, with some of the actual vehicles that set the record, including the 1902 California Machine that was the first vehicle ever to cross the country. And that will be there along with the last vehicle to set a record, the infamous Audi S6 Fraud Taurus. And I believe Ed will be there as well with his CL55 and many other Cannonball record setters and celebrities. So we're very excited for that. That is the Cars Are the Stars event, September 14th in Minerva, Ohio, and we will put a link for tickets in the show notes. So with that out of the way, now we will jump right into it.
Sounds great.
Yeah. So we closed off last episode with Cannonball Baker's final record in 1933, which was 53.5 hours. Now, it's been widely published and believed, and even still in modern publications, Haggerty recently posted something that 1933 was the last transcontinental record until Brock Yates and his friends and his son went out in 1971, so that the record stood for almost 40 years. However, thanks to some historians, including Mason Dibley, we have uncovered three records that happened in between 1933 and 1971. So let's cover those briefly, and then we'll get into the races. June 8 through 10, 1959, a man named John Penton went in a BMW or on a BMW R69 motorcycle and set a time of 52 hours and 11 minutes. So he barely sneaked by a Cannonball Baker's record. The kind of the coolest one, I think, is August 12 through 14, 1965. Stanley Rosenthal, Herman Skip John, went in a Sunbeam Imp sports sedan, which is a tiny little rear engine car, not known for power or reliability even, but they went out and set a pretty darn quick time of 48 hours and 9 minutes. Now, it's interesting to note that neither Brock Yates nor Steve Smith were aware of this record when they set out and did theirs. Given their respective careers in automotive journalism, this record was done for the American Rodding magazine, and it was definitely publicized. Some interesting things to note about that run, though, is they did not initially set out to break a cross-country record. They set out, similar to the pre-war records, in order to prove the reliability and just kind of the feasibility of using an IMP sports sedan for this type of drive. It was a publicity thing for the Sunbeam company, and they documented everything for American Rodding magazine, and it's a really neat read online. But in this little tiny car, they left from New York City, ended up in Los Angeles, just over, I think it was 3,000 miles was their route, and it was done in 48 hours and 9 minutes. And it's probably the goofiest looking vehicle that's ever set a cannonball record. Not too long after that, in 1968, Tibor Serosi, again on a BMW R69 motorcycle, set a blistering time of 45 hours and 41 minutes. And that would mark the last time that a motorcycle held the overall cannonball record. Ever since then, it has been cars. There's been some pretty fast motorcycle times, but never faster than cars. Now, Brock may not have known about Tibor Serosi's record, or, you know, it may just be that the Tibor Serosi Sea to Shining Sea Memorial Trophy Dash wouldn't have quite the same ring to it. And, you know, I don't know what the shortened name would be either, you know, Serosi Soiree or the Tibor Tango.
It sounds like a charity event, but I think that, you know, certainly Irwin Cannonball Baker was very well known, not just for the New York to L.A. or the cross country records, but all the point to point records. And so probably still more reflective of the spirit of Cannonball than as we know it than the other guys. But, you know, it's even for us, as we've set out to try to compile all the records over the last, let's say, 5 years of doing this in greater earnest, it's still, you know, every year we almost double the size of the list. And
right.
So it's, I think we were at like 100-ish originally, and now it's probably like 450 or something like that of times that have been documented. And so even if you really want to know, it can be super duper hard to figure out exactly where they all are.
Absolutely. Well, they're archived in libraries and stuff. Not everything has been digitized. It's very tough to find some of this information. There may have only been one quick blurb about it. In fact, even the Graham Page record by Cannonball Baker in 33, there's almost no information about it. There's right. really nothing. We don't know even what color the car he drove was. There's no photos of it. So yes, it is a fun adventure to try to unearth these previously unknown records. And disclaimer, this record, this list, this documentary, whatever we're doing here is open to revision as we find more records. This is the most complete, most accurate chronicle to date. Things may change. This is what we know so far. Switchcast is brought to you by Boxcast. Boxcast is a live streaming company based in Cleveland, Ohio, and they serve broadcasters and viewers around the world. Their founders launched Boxcast back in 2013 with one purpose: to make people part of the experience. If you're looking to live stream your podcast, church service, car show, sporting event, your wedding, or even your cannonball attempt, Boxcast is an easy, flexible live streaming platform for organizations and individuals. Boxcast is so easy, we're broadcasting this from a phone. Head over to switchcars.com/boxcast for your free trial. Again, it's switchcars.com/boxcast for your free trial. So, with that said, 1971, the genesis of the second era and maybe the golden era of Cannonball. Ed, walk us through a little bit the 1971 run in the Dodge Sportsman van.
Yeah, so you can't really say that even the pursuit beforehand matters nearly as much as it does without focusing on how critical and canonical the actual cannonballs were. And, you know, we'll talk a lot about why most of the participants, Brock Yates and Jack May included, felt like these were the only ones and that everything else was so extracurricular that it really didn't count within the canon or within, you know, what would really, you know, matter within this perspective of history. And so when Brock Yates and Steve Smith had the idea in 1971 to go out and try it in sort of the first version of the Moon Trash Van, and they ended up taking Brock Yates Jr., you know, it was really an exploration into what was possible in that day, because regardless of whether or not we recognize these other times that happened, you know, between the 30s and the 70s, it was still, you know, nobody had seen it real recently. And the pace at which freeway expansion was happening and how much easier it was becoming to cross the country in an automobile, it was going to be a whole brave new world. And they didn't really know what to expect. And there was some thought of it not being just them, but as we all know about cannonball attempts, most of the people who say they'll go end up not showing up. And so it was just the Moon Trash team heading out in the spring of 71. And it was so informative that, you know, it really did green light and authenticate the notion that a race was possible. Now, a race was still not responsible back then. And the idea that they were able to really, under the umbrella of Car and Driver magazine, be able to organize the longest street race in history, you know, to me is super duper awesome. And obviously, it was never going to last forever. But for them to go out and then within the same year, we know how hard it is to, you know, plan any of this stuff. But late in 71, to be able to do the initial like real record-setting run in the Daytona, dropping into the 35s, to me was just the coolest thing ever. And it was just an amazing proof of concept to be able to move that fast, spool it up, and generate enough interest, valid interest, of people that were going to show up at the starting line to get out there and do it.
Yep. So for the numbers, the run in 1971, it was May 3rd and 4th, and we can't forget Jim Williams either, who was the fourth passenger in the Moon Trash Van. That was 40 hours and 51 minutes, and I believe they set out to break 40 hours, but ran into quite a bit of traffic on the western part of the run, which is par for the course in Cannonball.
It does happen, yes.
Yeah, it does happen. But the article that Brock wrote subsequently in Car and Driver garnered so much attention that all of those people who previously were not ready to show up yet all of a sudden wrote to him and said, "We're in. Let's race. I can beat your time." You know, the Polish Racing Drivers of America, that team came out of the woodworks and issued him a challenge, and it became an event.
Most certainly. And I mean, you know, we know today that when we've seen the more modern interpretations of a competitive cross-country event, you see a wide spectrum of competitiveness. And I think that was even more present back then than even we see today on these low budget or old car events, where there's always, you know, 10 to 20% of the field that takes it super seriously. And then the rest of the people are just there for the adventure. And that was absolutely true back then. And when you hear the stories from the drivers back then, it's reflected in their attitude that, like, yeah, well, I don't know what time it was, you know, or they know exactly what time it was. And they have all the excuses to get between whatever their time was and whatever time won that year.
Yeah. I didn't take it real seriously. You know, that's Bill Warner is a great example of that. He's arguably one of the greatest storytellers of his generation. And he describes the 70s Cannonballs as a complete lark. Now, that would fit because he finished mid-pack and, you know, Jack May, no, this is a real serious thing. But the 1971 race in November was probably one of the more special ones. They're all more special for one reason or another, but because of the car used and the people who won it. So Ed, you have a very special connection to this one as well. Talk us through the winners of the 1971 Cannonball race in November.
Absolutely. So Brock Yates had kind of just made almost a shallow invitation to Dan Gurney to join, not believing there was any chance that was actually going to happen. He had some backup plans for co-drivers in the event that Dan couldn't show up. And Dan was told not to go by all his sponsors, by everybody, for the same reason that, you know, today we don't see the greatest NBA players showing up at slam dunk contests, right? Because it's like if they show up and lose, it's way more costly than it is to show up and the gain that could be there from winning. But Dan obviously thought it was cool enough to do, and they showed up in a borrowed Ferrari Daytona from Kirk F. White. And, I, you know, to me, it's obviously the ultimate cannonball car. It is the ultimate cannonball car from a value perspective today. It was painted Sunoco blue, repainted from that. And since then, the motor's been swapped and it's been, restored kind of weekly in the 80s. But at the end of the day, it's sold several times. It's in the McCall collection and they have responded favorably to all the offers that I've made, which are plentiful,
too low,
steadily increasing, but I guess not approaching the actual value, not certainly the sentimental value that others enjoy of the car as I do.
I would say the number of offers is likely plentiful, but the amount of the offer is not plentiful enough. We know you, Ed.
That is fair. That is fair. Although I feel like I'm getting there, but I guess I'm not.
So I believe, if memory serves me correctly, Dan Gurney called up Brock the day before the race, and Brock had a co-driver, and he basically said, "See ya." Nope. Dan
exactly.
Gurney's coming.
Yeah, you're not going to say, nobody gets to stand in the way of Dan Gurney getting to do whatever he wants. And I think that there was so much validation of the event to have had Dan Gurney as a winner that there was, you could never have said no. You would have had to find another car and just give Dan his car. But, you know, reading about that run in Brock's book and how cathartic and satisfying it was to have actually been able to organize a multi-car event, to have co-driven with Dan Gurney in the ultimate touring car of history at that point. You know, it was everything that he ever wanted Cannonball to be. And I think as we all manifest our Cannonball fantasies, I think it's important to, you know, just think about what it is, whether it's, you know, Ben Wilson organizing the most ridiculous cars, or John Ficarra doing it so inexpensively, or me doing it all, you know, with every dollar that I had, in my 20s, or, you know, the way that you guys have pulled out all the stops. You know, it's all been our own version of what Cannonball and what loving cars means to us. And so the romantic nature of the way that Brock wrote about it in his book from 2001, to me, was just so special. And it was very clear that in that moment, he had achieved exactly what he wanted to. And I'm happy that it was, at least, you know, there was something else there on the table so that the event could continue into the next few years.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that was a very special time as well. You know, none of us can get Mercedes or Audi or anybody to even acknowledge the fact that we set a record. No thanks for the free marketing. But back then, as you mentioned, Kirk White, he was a car dealer. He loaned them a Ferrari to go set this record. I'm like, that can never happen. But that was so awesome. Those were the days. Those were the good old days. So they set a time of 35 hours and 54 minutes. So smashed the 40-hour barrier. And that was the last event that Brock Yates won of the ones that he planned, which, reading his book and hearing stories, that really, really chapped his rear end. He was incredibly competitive and wanted to win every event that he planned, but other people had better ideas and were faster. So at least he won one.
There were different wins available, right? So, you know, to build the Challenger was a win because he obviously mm-hmm. didn't get to keep the Daytona, and to build the ambulance and let that become the infrastructure for the movie was a win. And I think that's where I've been so pleased with the more recent history of Cannonball Pursuit, is that our cohort, our friends, are all finding their wins in the world of Cannonball. And I think that's the best thing that we could do to honor the significance of this era, is to say, look, you know, this is where we really are seeing, people pulling out all the stops for themselves, putting themselves into that context and coming away with the kind of memories that last for 50 years.
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely. And you talk to any of the original Cannonballers, and that is still a highlight of their life. They remember every bit about it, and they love recounting the stories. And I think it's important for us and for them that the legacy has continued, because after 1983, there were no runs until 2006. And so we've kind of revalidated their runs and brought them back into the limelight in a sense. We're able to share, you know, multi-generationally this appreciation of Cannonball. So it's given them a new audience in order to tell their stories to.
That's exactly right. And, you know, we now, as we have hammered it down the throats of an internet enthusiast audience and talk about Cannonball a lot more than anyone ever did before us, we think of Cannonball in the realist sense, the Brock Yates events, as being this long-standing piece of history. But it's four competitive runs, 71, 72, 75, and 79. And in reality, the next one we should talk about, being 72, was a little bit of a non-event because it was so wrought with challenges and traffic and weather that nobody really put down any impressive times. And it's what really made them take 75 so seriously.
Yep. So let's talk about 75. So there's a few year hiatus, and then the 55 mile an hour speed limit was enacted. Many people, the common theme is that the Cannonball was created in order to protest the 55 mile an hour speed limit. Well, there's a problem with timelines there because the Cannonball started in 71 and had run three times before that was actually enacted. But it gave new impetus for these racers. They had a new challenge, something new to protest against. And, you know, the 55 mile an hour speed limit wasn't even about safety. It was during the oil embargo. So it was about fuel efficiency. Brock had some very strong political feelings and certainly created the race initially kind of as not only a tribute to Cannonball Baker, but also a protest against what he felt was overreaching government rules and regulations. So that just gave them 55 more reasons to challenge it. So let's talk about the 75 run.
Yeah, so, and it's important to say that, he began it with this thesis that capable drivers in capable cars were capable of driving a lot faster than we thought. And when between 72 and 75, when he was given a much better excuse, it's kind of the greatest enabling that ever happened to somebody who was already preparing to make some bad decisions. And it's no different than coming across the perfect co-driver today. Like, I had this stupid idea, and now I found another guy that has a stupider idea. And I now have, some company in the misery I plan to experience, and at least somebody to relate to across the jail cell, if that's where it ends up. And so I think that the fact that they were, it just supercharged everything that was, but it didn't result in people going all that much faster.
That's right. Only a minute faster. It was another Ferrari that set the record, and it was Jack May and Rick Klein in a beautiful white Ferrari Dino, which Jack May still owns. It's very cool to see how many of these cars are still in the hands of their original owners who ran the Cannonball, and that is one of them. And they beat Dan Gurney's and Brock Yates' time by 1 minute exactly, reducing the record to 35 hours and 53 minutes. Now, there's a very interesting side note about this. the modern Cannonball community has had its share of, I would say, legitimate drama, at least in calling out a fraud, and certainly got a little bit of bad press in the midst of that for our backbiting and stuff from a not too kind Road and Track article. But in general, the Cannonball community, the modern community, is very tight knit, and some of the OG Cannonballers have mentioned to us, like, I can't believe you guys are all so tight and so friendly, because there was a lot of big egos and a lot of competition. And I talked to one guy who said, I hated Brock Yates. I can't stand that guy. And I'm like, what are you talking about? He enabled this opportunity for you. But there was so much, so many egos, and Jack May, great guy, but he is an example of that as well. He claims that his 1975 Cannonball record is the last one, and that he holds in one of his posters, he says that he holds the Cannonball record in perpetuity. His record has never been beaten, never can be beaten, because it was the last official Cannonball that went from New York to L.A., because in 1975, Brock moved it to Darien, Connecticut, to the Lock, Stock and Barrel restaurant. Because of the, I'm sorry, 79. What did I say?
Oh, all good.
Yes. Yeah. From 75 to 79. Yeah. Yeah, but it was 50 miles longer, but it was still an official cannonball. So what happened in 1979?
So in 1979, they went from Darien to still to the Portofino, and that was a strange one because there was a lot of billing. It was well known that a movie was happening. And so Brock Yates was going to be co-driving with Hal Needham, who was going to be obviously a heavy presence in the creation of the film. And a lot of the drivers were told that they were going to be in the movie, that they were going to use the actual footage. And so they were like, you know, going all out and building all their costumes and the craziest cars they could so that maybe their car would be showcased or featured or whatever. And what we learned is that the stories survived, but the actual personalities were actors. And it when it's much better for that, regardless of what you think about the quality of the film. And so the idea of this ambulance as the ultimate car, you know, it's one of those things that we always think about, like, well, you know, if I could do this and budget weren't a thing and we could go and build the ultimate ride, this is what it would look like. And so a Winston Cup motor in a Dodge van is obviously proven many, many times, sometimes at my own expense, to not be the most efficient way to cross the country. But it sounded good on paper and it looked great on film and it became, you know, such a great representation of what Cannonball was. That's where we ended up with the actual experience that Brock Yates and Hal had, along with the doctor. What was his name? That they took with them.
Dr. Lyle.
Lyle Royer. And they were able to talk a cop out of arresting them at over 100 miles an hour, claiming that they had a senator's wife who was Pam Yates, not at that point married to Brock Yates, and she had to be transported to the UCLA Medical Center, couldn't be in a pressurized airplane cabin because her body would erupt in cysts. And I think the greatest ruse inevitably in Cannonball history, and the fact that it worked is amazing. The fact that they've reconnected with the officer is just so poetic and so amazing. And so they most certainly did not win because they did not finish. They broke down near the Calbazon Dinosaurs and had to be towed in and then pushed around the Long Beach Grand Prix and a whole lot of other just amazing moments, again, in the historical timeline of Cannonball. But the event was won, and this becoming the final official Cannonball Baker Sea to Shining Sea Memorial Trophy Dash by Dave Hyde and Dave Yarborough in a 1979 Jaguar XJS with a time of 32 hours and 51 minutes.
I'll correct you there. It's a 78 Jaguar XJS. Oh, the 78 and 79 are identical, but you know, got to have our facts straight here.
That one's dead to us anyway.
It's just dead, period.
I
think Fred will resurrect it. So I find it interesting. Well, you said the ambulance is not the greatest thing with a NASCAR engine swap, but I would just say engine swaps in general are not have not proven to be the greatest choice for Cannonball. I've experienced that myself as well. I also like that Brock, you know, looking back in the early era, right? So we have three different Ferraris and a Jaguar that set records in the 70s and 80s, but Brock chose a van twice. And I think the van of that era was similar to the modern German sports sedan. It was the vehicle that was most practical. You could put tons and tons of fuel in it. You could put a port-a-loo in the back. You could put a bed in, and it somewhat flew under the radar. So that was subtle choice of the day. Although, you know, making it into an ambulance isn't so subtle, but it was a good disguise.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that was, there was a lot that happened in that event. Some of it was very public. Some of it wasn't. There was the thought that perhaps the Countach was going to compete that year and it wasn't ready. And that's where, you know, you've told a bit about that was the car that sort of killed Cannonball because Brock really got scared of what could be. And I think that, you know, it was the year that John Harrison went and they crashed near your home on the in the Esprit. Not the first Cannonball crash. In fact, that was 79 with the good old Wright Bra Racing team spinning out in, I believe, an ambulance that was owned by Rocky Aoki. And they
limo.
A limo. Yep. And so that was the only real Cannonball injury of all time. One of the girls that was not seatbelted in asleep broke her arm. But I think that, you know, I think Brock was able to look back at it as a lot of us do at the end of 79 and just say, I've done all the things that I care to do, and I've experienced as much triumph and as much pain as perhaps I'm entitled to. And I think the idea that it was sort of the right end point, knowing obviously that the movie was in the wings. And I just think, you know, at some point we all look back and say, you know, of this passion, of this interest, we've done enough. And I think the idea that 79 was it, even though there were many, many thoughts like there are in all of us, like, well, what if I did this, or what if I did that, or what if we all did this? But the idea that one lap was the eventual outcome there rather than another competitive event. But of course, as we came to find out, not everybody was done with Cannonball, as they never are. And Mr. Daugherty had to take the reins from there.
Celebrity Machines is a proud sponsor of Switchcast. Celebrity Machines offers more than 250 different screen-accurate license plates as they appeared in movies and TV shows like Back to the Future, Ghostbusters, The Fast and the Furious, Breaking Bad, and so many more. Celebrity Machines also makes our dealer insert plates as well as our commemorative 2539 plates from the fastest Cannonball run ever. If you're looking for a gift for somebody you like or for garage art for your own place, check out celebritymachines.com for more info and use promo code SWITCHCAST for a 25.39% discount at checkout. Again, go to celebritymachines.com and use discount code SWITCHCAST. So some might say that 79 was the end of an era, but it wasn't entirely. It was the end of the official Cannonball run, but Rick Daugherty and some other super serious racers from the Cannonball started a new thing called the U.S. Express, and it took off from there for the next 4 years.
Correct. Yeah. So Rick was a Cannonballer, but you know, certainly wasn't done with it, as a lot of us still have obsessions and ideas and things we want to explore as we pursue this ridiculous idea. And so they went out and they were, it appears from all the things that we can read, and there's not all that much out there. It appears that this was taken generally a little bit more seriously. There were fewer, you know, crazy supercars and fewer slow cars. There were a lot more German cars, Porsches, some Panteras, some cars that were perhaps a little bit more well-suited for taking this kind of thing seriously. But of course, a Ferrari still becomes the fastest to ever do it. We don't have all the times for every running, but it is obviously believed that it was run four times, 80, 81, 82, 83. And no one went faster than the Jag until 83. And I think that's a very, very interesting idea, because the Jag's time was probably the most contested, that took the most runs before it actually fell.
Hmm. Yeah, that's a good record in and of itself.
For sure. Because, you know, as you said, there's no real evidence that anyone tried hard to reduce it from the 83 time until Alex Roy's run. And there wasn't a whole lot of evidence that anybody had tried in earnest to beat Alex Roy's run until we did it. Alex always told me that he thought 4 to 6 people a year did it, but they managed not to tell anybody. And so I don't necessarily know if that was true. But taking it from 3251 in 1979 down to 3207 in 1983 in a Ferrari 308, which is just awesome with its giant headlights. And it's awesome that David Diem still owns that car. He went with David Turner and they won a lot of good Daves.
Doug Turner.
In the success. Doug Turner. Yeah. A lot of good Daves in the history of Cannonball.
But there are, yes.
And I think the car's super cool. I have made him some also insulting offers to buy it that I'm very pleased that he did not choose to accept for all the reasons, mostly that he loves it so much and that I don't have to maintain it. But he has continued to own that car now over 40 years and loves it, takes it to shows and events, and it's still in running condition. He does sort of regret that he took out all the gadgets, took out the fuel bladder, took out the auxiliary driving lights, but I think it's probably about time to scour eBay and get some Fuzzbusters and some old Hellas and see what we can make it look like.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Although that one's not a hard one to duplicate. It's, you know, it's just a Ferrari 308 GTSI in red. There's plenty of them out there. So, and it is interesting, as you said, that the people who allegedly took the Cannonball the most seriously were not able to best the last Cannonball time in three different runnings of it. And information on those runnings is somewhat limited. We've uncovered a fair amount of it, but they did not document it like Brock did, of course, being a journalist. And if you want, the book Cannonball by Brock Yates, for those of you listening or watching, has all of the times from 1971 through 1979. But for instance, I don't think we know anything about the 1980 U.S. Express. We have a general idea of 81, 82, and 83, but not comprehensive lists. I believe Rick Doherty won it in 81. In a Mazda RX-7, and Mike DeJonas won it in 82 in a Ditamasa Pantera, which was heavily, heavily prepared and full roll cage and everything. And I think they won, I don't remember what award it was, but they had gotten pulled over something like 12 times across the country. Their motto was just essentially go as fast as possible. Don't worry about the consequences. And, you know, somehow we're able to overcome all of the stop time for those tickets with just driving really, really fast. And speaking of original era cars that are for sale, his car recently was up for sale in Europe, but unfortunately they had unrestored it or undone it from its Cannonball guys and restored it to a different period when he was club racing, which is unfortunate because I think the highest value for that car is as the 82 winner of the U.S. Express, at least to this small group of nerds that is overpaying for things like Brock Yates' Challenger and might overpay for Rick May's, Jack May's Dino. So
that's it. That's right up your alley, dude. You got to.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. So, yeah, the might be the first original owner of a Cannonball car who still owns it that is offering it up for sale. Every other Cannonball record car that has changed hands has been after a death. So Jack May is the only actual owner who's willing to part with his car. Now it's for a hefty sum. I believe he's asking $750,000. So that's definitely a large premium for being a Cannonball record car. But given the premium that was paid for Brock Yates' Challenger and some other vehicles, it may be warranted. So I think your CL55 is worth at least double what another ratty CL55 is.
Oh, man.
$20,000?
Who knows? But, you know, Alex always told me that he had some offers of like 75 on the E39 when it was worth, you know, $20,000 as a regular car. So who knows?
I believe that.
According to Haggerty, that's what mine's worth. But I don't think anybody's lining up to pay it. But I think that the U.S. Express was hugely significant because it did offer an evidence that carrying the torch was a real thing. And as we see the history since 1979 take a lot of different forms, some of which were well received and some were not by, you know, the community at large, it just illustrated that what Brock Yates and Steve Smith started was not something that was simply going to, you know, die into the pages of history. It was a fire that had been lit in a lot of us in a lot of different ways, and it was going to result in a lot of interesting things to happen throughout automotive history. You know, the thing that happened most immediately after the cessation of the U.S. Express was called the Four Ball Rally. which raced amongst a lot of different routes and is super duper weird because the original organizer was murdered and then his father ran it with a $10,000 cash prize. And we recently had a story from Jim Smoot, who was one of the participants that ran in a modified van, and they were not nearly as successful as they thought they might be, as most people who take vans find, other than our good buddy Yummy. But I think that there is a, it was just a great signaling that you could take the idea of Cannonball and you could put it into your own context, and you could still be part of the group. And I think that's the most lovely thing about it today, is that in the same way that Jack May is able to claim, well, I was the only competitive official running New York to LA record holder. You know what? Yes, you were. And don't let anybody take that away from you. And I think that the way we've had EV records and nonstop records and round trip records and motorcycle records and Southern Route records and all the other things that people have decided were their brand of cannonballing in today's context, I think the fact that we saw that so clearly happen with the US Express and the four ball was really the invitation to a lot of us to say, it's okay to put this into whatever it means to you and then take it from there. It doesn't mean that it's official. There's no governing body of illegal outlaw cross-country road racing, thank the Lord, because I'd probably have to be part of it. And I think the fact that it's done so many things since then is really a testament to the fact that Rick Daugherty had the wherewithal and the gumption to decide that he was going to be the only guy willing to put his name on the organizational letters.
Yep. Yep, absolutely. And there's a few people in modern times that are willing to do that. God bless them for that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I always say that we're all crazy in this room, but there's a couple extra crazy people that are the ones that send you invitations for this mess. And don't forget that they're the ones that belong on Mount Rushmore, not us.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah, I think you said it well. I'm going to say it less well, but the people who ran the original Cannonball often maintain that that's the only one that counts, and what has been built upon it isn't real Cannonball and doesn't count. And while we absolutely respect and hold in awe what was done during that time and could never repeat it, because if you did a modern run with that level of visibility and that comparative level of competition and horsepower and everything, it would end poorly. It's just, it's a terrible idea in modern times. But I think we all recognize as modern runners that we stand on the shoulders of giants that have come before us, that have made what we do important and relevant. Otherwise, driving from New York to LA in 25 hours, while it would be interesting, I think it would not be viewed as positively as it is, because we have this 120-year history, and because Cannonball was painted in such a great light because of the movie, everybody has these fond memories of it. So we stand on the shoulders of giants in that respect. But I think it's also important to remind the giants on whose shoulders we stand that the Cannonball itself did not begin and end in 71 and 79. There's a reason it was called the Cannonball Baker Memorial Trophy Dash. They were standing on the shoulders of another giant and many people who had come before as well. And that's kind of why we're doing this documentary, to kind of cover it in the three different eras in which it happened. This 70s and 80s were a special era that cannot be repeated and won't be. And the Cannonball run as it was then is supremely special, but it does not negate what came before or what came after it. It's a whole part of the overall picture, I think.
That's exactly right. I would say that this was the era in which Cannonball was immortalized, and it was the proper way to call upon and unify the history that came before 1970, and the proper way to pave the opportunity for all of us that wanted to come afterwards. Now, that may not have been their intention, but it has, you know, evolved into so many other amazing events. In 84, launching the One Lap of America, and all of the things that we've done since then to celebrate, you know, just the cannonballs that they did. There was the Backroads cannonball that Brock did years later. And so there were a lot of other things that were, you know, attempts at more legitimately carrying that torch. But the fact that it is a sort of an extra legal event and an off the wall pursuit means that it's a tiger by the tail. And I think that's one of the things that Brock Yates recognized in the late 70s and certainly into the 80s was that this could get real out of hand real fast. And we all count our blessings so much that whatever our participation in and hopefully contribution to as it pertains to Cannonball was done safely enough, right? That we all got away with it, or at least got away with it with just the bills and a couple tickets to show for it. And I think that, you know, that's it has built this community. And, you know, whether or not open saying I'm the godfather of it, the only thing I want to be the godfather of is the open invitation for Cannonball to mean as much to other people as it has to me. And I count myself most blessed that it was the right challenge at the right moment in my life to be able to sort of prove to myself much more than prove to the world that what I mean when I say that I love cars is something that I've been able to live up to. And I think that when I wrote my book about it, it was very much that. It was like, you know, an invitation to my son and to anybody who watches what I do to say that there is some challenge out there that is the perfect representation of your love for a hobby, for an idea, for a person. And if you can find the thing that is the litmus test, that is the proving grounds for that notion and achieve it, then you'll feel as fortunate as anybody who's ever lived. And it's my hope that for especially Yates and Daugherty, as they were able to look back on their contributions to this immortalizing era of driving across the country, that it was them achieving everything that they wanted, because we certainly celebrate what they did as humans, as journalists, as people, as friends, as family members. And the fact that this could be part of that, this stupid idea of driving cars a long way and not sleeping and peeing in bottles and whatever that means, that it's become so much bigger, so much greater. It doesn't get any better than that.
Yeah. And the way you stated that and your open kind of encouragement of people to define Cannonball for themselves is, I think, why we regard you as the godfather of it and Alex Roy as the pioneer. Because you read Alex Roy's book and you don't want to do it. You don't want to do a Cannonball. And I think that was... there were multiple reasons for that. He didn't want his record beaten, but maybe there are some legal reasons as well. He wanted to scare people away from doing it because he didn't want to be seen as encouraging people to do something illegal and allegedly dangerous. But just the contrast between the somewhat exclusive attitude of the Cannonballers in the 70s saying this is the only Cannonball, this is the only thing that counts, this is you can't call it a Cannonball because you didn't do it the same way we did, versus you inviting people to say what does Cannonball mean to you, you know, do the run in whatever makes sense for you, obviously in the same spirit of the Cannonball and maintaining the safety record, but you know, it is open arms to the community. And I think that's why our community is regarded as being so welcoming. Despite our differences, we have created or you have created that culture, and that culture has continued to manifest itself throughout the community. And I think that's a good thing. Despite the competition and the egos, we get along quite well and are encouraging of others. And you know, I've helped scout, and Arnie has helped scout for other teams that were, you know, possibly going to break our record. So it's a hard thing to do, but at the same time, we want to support them and support the community. And you've been a huge support to myself and Arnie as well, despite the threat to your record status. So I think that's really important in terms of your perspective on this and your words to the public regarding Cannonball. So I think it's a good contrast from, you know, the other side of things.
Well, I appreciate that. You're very kind to say so. And it has enriched my life in more ways than I ever had imagined or hoped for. And I can't wait to see where it goes in the next 120 years.
Switch Cars is the enthusiast dealership where we buy, sell, consign, service, and store only cars that we like ourselves. Well, we'll store anything that pays the bill, except EVs. We're not going to store EVs, and we definitely don't sell them either. Anyway, check out our handpicked inventory at switchcars.com and mention discount code SWITCHCAST for your special pricing. That's right, check out our handpicked inventory at switchcars.com. So the first era of Cannonball, we said the kind of the driving force behind it was proving that we needed interstate highways and proving the efficacy and the possibility of vehicles crossing the country and of that being a reliable mode of transportation for the general public, and also manufacturers trying to prove that their cars were better or more reliable. So for that era, that was kind of the point of quote unquote Cannonball. What do you think was the point? What was the driving force behind the second era?
Well, this was the point of organization, right? They were all the one-off time trial events. And even since the 70s and 80s, we've seen that divergence, that there are the one-off time trial events like ours where we go out and the records actually advance. And then there are the competitive events, and we've used the biggest air quotes ever when we're driving cheap, old, unreliable cars as competitive. But I think, you know, this was sort of the fulcrum of history there where, you know, the idea became a thing and it became organized. It became something that you could put into an article, put into a blurb, put into an invitation rather than a, hey, what if we did this kind of idea, which is what it was prior to that, whether it was from an auto manufacturer, from a crazy person. And, you know, I think it all works. And I think it all works because they decided to take the time, take the risks and take the effort to turn it into a proper event.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. I'm going to close with a quote from Brock Yates' book about the run. I think it's very good. And also viewers can see here, there's a DVD called 3207. And that is a documentary done on the 83 U.S. Express, but more specifically, David Diem's and Doug Turner's record winning run. And then obviously into Alex Roy and Dave Marr's run in 2006. So that's a fantastic documentary to watch if you can find the DVD anywhere. If you can't, you can watch Alex Roy's revised version called Apex. So this is Brock Yates speaking about kind of the era of 70s Cannonballs. I think it sums up well. Quote, I suppose half the fun of the Cannonball Baker was anticipating the indignant hen clucking that would arise in its wake, that the expected denouncement of the affair by responsible, clear-headed citizens properly outraged by the idea of motorized Visigoths ripping over the highways of America was going to be a byproduct of the event that would offer us a rebuttal wherein the more serious motives of the Cannonball might be articulated. That wave of indignation never came. Aside from a pubescent West Coast motorsports writer whining that it was a crime and Sports Illustrated grumbling that certain aspects of the race were deplorable, very little flack came our way. In fact, praise arrived from utterly shocking sources. One highly prestigious member of the FIA called Kirk White twice to express his enthusiasm for the Cannonball Baker concept. America was, both Radio Free Europe and the Voice of America gave the race coverage in an effort, one producer told me, to inform the world that far from being a police state, America was still the scene of enterprising individual adventure. Nevertheless, I think the Cannonball Baker does demand justification, mainly because we feel it symbolizes something far deeper than a simple-minded dash from coast to coast. To begin with, it was not a flat-out race. Surely the idea of running across this nation in under 36 hours conjures up visions of hammering along for hours on end at 150 miles an hour. Dan Gurney's whimsical, rather ironic statement to the press that we never exceeded 175 miles per hour only reinforced that idea. We did, in fact, briefly run the Ferrari to an indicated 172 miles per hour on an empty stretch of Interstate 10 in California, merely to determine the limits of the machine, but the majority of the trip was run at 90 to 95 miles per hour, a mere saunter for the Ferrari. The quickness of the journey was hardly attributable to outright speed, but rather to good routes, rapid stops, and assiduously staying clear of traffic. When Dan and I got to the Portofino, we agreed that the part of the Cannonball which we were proudest about was the fact that we had bothered no one. We hadn't jeopardized the safety of anyone, including ourselves. We had driven very fast, but we had driven cleanly, efficiently, and safely.
Doesn't get much better than that.
Nope. Yep. So if you enjoyed this, go read the book. It's much better, much, much better. But next episode, next week, I'll be joined by Ben Charlie Safari Wilson, who was one of the founders of the modern semi-lark-ish races with cheap cars and unreliable cars. But he has a wonderful perspective on the Cannonball, and we're going to cover the modern era of records from Alex Roy through, of course, Ed Bullion, and all the way through our records and the pandemic era of things. So thank you, Ed, so much for joining me, for your incredible and unique perspective on this. And thank you all for joining us as well.
Thanks so much.